This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And boy, do I have a big day for you, and I mean big! Because today is a whale of a day, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Brian Scarry. Hi, Brian, are you there?
Yeah, sure am, Patsy. Great to be with you.
Okay, did I pronounce it right? It's Scarry?
Yes, Scarry. It's like Carrie with an F.
Scarry. And Scarry, and you do some, but what a perfect name for you, because you do some really scary stuff.
I guess so.
Oh, wow. Oh. I'm thinking when you were a kid, did they teach you, you know, tease you with that name and say, oh, Scarry, Scarry? And then you turn out to be a guy who swims with the whales, my goodness, and sharks, and I don't know what else out there.
Exactly. Yep, that's true.
That's what I thought. Oh, kids can be so funny. What can I say about this book? It is big. It is wonderful. It is terrific. It's quite amazing. So where do you want to start? How can you, according to the thing, you spent like, 12,000 hours under the water, which is like, what? That's like days and days. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, I started diving and exploring the world's oceans when I was about 15 years old. I had always loved the ocean. There was something that spoke to me about it, and I just wanted to be an ocean explorer. And then it was maybe after a year or two of diving that I discovered photography, and that to me, that was the way I wanted to explore, with a camera. And the notion of telling stories about all the things I was seeing in the ocean really appealed to me. So I set this very ambitious goal of becoming a National Geographic magazine photographer, which in hindsight was a very lofty dream coming from a little sort of textile mill town in New England. But dreams do come true. In 1998, I started working with National Geographic, and my latest project after 23 years is Secrets of the Whales, this new book. It's also a four-part TV series on Disney Plus, streaming on Earth Day, and a cover story in the magazine in the May issue. So it's been a three-year project, nonstop, 24 locations and around the world, to tell the story of whale culture, these very complex societies in the ocean.
Oh, well, it is beautifully told. Of course, Nat Geo. It's just so amazing. I grew up with Nat Geo. It was the thrill of our life when we used to get them. I lived in a little town in little middle of nowhere, and that was really the only magazine that we got. And it was such a thrill. And still today, I get such a thrill with Nat Geo books. And I tell everyone, if you're going to give a gift, give a Nat Geo book, because no one ever gives away a Nat Geo book. They are really a joy forever.
That's so true, isn't it? I know. It's one of the, even the magazine, it's one of those magazines that, you know, is busting our attics apart because we just can't throw them away. They seem to be collected. But, you know, it's one of those magazines that you can go back and look at, you know, a 100-year-old issue or a 50-year-old issue, and it's still exciting to read. I mean, the things that they were talking about then, the different types of photography that were being done, they're very relevant today. I think you can still find some connections there, and even with the underwater stories, I love going back and comparing the stories that I'm doing today, like whales, with the stories that were done just a few decades ago, and how much things have changed.
And well, of course, now, I mean, your methods for going underwater are different too. There's so many exciting advances in the exploration of the sea in general, and then that you have been such a very, very big part of it.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a very exciting time for both ocean exploration and storytelling. The science that is revealing so much more about these animals in the ocean. With Secrets of the Whales, I created this project based on the latest and greatest science that was showing that whales, like humans, have these rich ancestral traditions, that they are doing things differently depending where in the world they live, and they're passing on that knowledge to their children. These are things that matter to them. Family matters to them, and their cultures. A whale biologist friend of mine, he describes the difference between behavior and culture like this. He says, behavior is what we do. Culture is how we do it. So, for example, most humans eat food with utensils. That is behavior. But whether you use chopsticks or knives and forks is your culture. Well, it turns out whales are doing this too. They're not using chopsticks or knives and forks, but they are doing things differently. The orca that live in New Zealand have a preference for eating stingrays, and they have figured out how to catch and eat stingrays, and they are the only orca in the world that do that. And the orca that live in Patagonia, Argentina, like to eat seals, and they figured out a strategy to do just that, and they are the only ones that do that. And sperm whales isolate by language. They have their own unique dialects, and they are isolating by families that speak the same language. So it's much like humans, and that's what Secrets of the Whales is about, is about looking at these families, these societies, through the lens of culture, which I think is a different take on things.
Now, explain to my listeners, because some people don't realize, that there are 5 species of whales. Tell us about them and a little bit about them, so right, people understand.
Sure. Yeah, so there's actually, many species of whales and dolphins, which are all part of the same family of cetaceans. But for Secrets of the Whales, the TV series, we focused on 5 species, and then with the book I added a couple of more. But the primary species that we're looking at here are the humpback whales, the sperm whales, the belugas, narwhals, and orca. And, there are basically 2 big classifications of whales. You have toothed whales, so whales that have teeth, which also have the ability to use sonar underwater. They use echolocation. And then there are baleen whales, like the humpback whales, or the blue whales, or gray whales, things like that, that don't have teeth, but they have baleen. They're like these big plates of material in their mouths that are made of the same material our fingernails are made with, and that's how they sift food through the ocean water. So each of these different whale species that we focused on for Secrets of the Whales, has these unique cultural aspects of their lives. They're doing things differently. Even within the genetically identical species, they're doing things differently depending where in the world they live.
Well, I mean, in some of your work, you've gotten really up close and personal with whales. Mm-hmm. What was the first time, the very first time, how old were you when you first encountered a whale?
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned that, Patsy. I actually described that in the introduction of my book, Secrets of the Whales, where I talk about, it was 1985, I was about 22, 23 years old, and I was out diving in Cape Cod Bay in Massachusetts. I was diving an old shipwreck, and I came up from the dive and was still in my dry suit and took off my tanks and so forth. And over the marine radio, I heard a fisherman, calling the Coast Guard, and he said he had a whale entangled in his lines, his fishing lines, his lobster lines. And he was leaving because there was nothing he could do to help the whale. He just gave the position to the Coast Guard. But I wrote down that position, and we took our boat over to that place. And I didn't see anything at first. The ocean was just quiet. And then all of a sudden, off the port side of my boat, this whale emerges. It's a humpback whale calf. It was about maybe 20 feet, 25 feet long, and it was all wrapped up in these lines. It could swim around a little bit, but it was like on a leash. The lobster pots on the bottom, I think, were preventing it from moving. So I didn't know better back then. I just jumped in the water. I still had my dry suit on, and I took a knife with me because I wanted to cut this whale out. Now, in hindsight, I know that was very dangerous, that, whales can be dangerous when they're entangled. They're not dangerous otherwise, but, you know, when he's all entangled and you're trying to cut him free, that could be a really dangerous thing to do. But I was pretty stupid when I was 20 years old and didn't know better. And I jumped in the water, and over maybe an hour or two, I was able to cut that whale out. And, you know, I remember him kind of calming down. He just got very relaxed, and he, I think, knew I was there to help him, and I was able to remove all the lines, and then he swam away, and I was hooked, you know, no pun intended. I just really fell in love with whales, and over the rest of my career, whenever I've had opportunities, I've proposed stories to National Geographic about dolphins and whales and tried to tell their stories. And this one, Secrets of the Whales, is the most exciting because it's really revealing how much like humans they are.
Well, I wanted you to tell my listeners that story, because when I read it, I thought, oh, my goodness. And I think that probably even if you would have known it was dangerous, you would have jumped in.
Probably.
I think so, because some things are just meant to be. And it's obvious that that was a sign that you were meant to be the whale man. And in the great sense of the word, not the way that people used to go out and kill these whales. I still cannot get it over that anyone could kill a whale. But you are like the whale godfather.
Yeah, you know, you're right. You think about, you know, 150 years ago and how, you know, there were all these whaling fleets all over the planet, you know, killing whales. And we're sort of looked at that today, and where it's repulsive to us to think of that. But, you know, they didn't know what we know today. To them, it was just a way to create whale oil, and we needed to run machines and burn the lamps of America and so forth back then to have light in the streets. And we just saw things very differently. But today we know that these are highly evolved animals. You know, the sperm whale has the biggest brain of any animal on the planet. You know, if you read Moby Dick, you read about an animal that was painted as a monster, as a leviathan that was smashing ships and so forth. But what I've seen by being in the water with these animals is that they are shy and gentle. They have deep affection for one another. They live in these families that are matrilineal. They are led by the older, wiser females of the group that make all the decisions. And, you know, life is hard in the ocean. They spend most of their life in the deep ocean, hundreds of meters deep, looking for squid to feed on and to eat. But every so often, every day or every couple of days, these families come together and they socialize, they rub against one another, they play together, they reaffirm those family bonds. And, you know, for me, this was a reminder that they are social creatures, we are social creatures, we need each other. We need family. We need community. It's a very important part of who both of these species really are.
Well, you have captured so many really unusual aspects of the whales, things that people didn't know about. And so one of the things, tell us about how, about that they name themselves or they have special language for themselves.
That's right. So, as I mentioned, for example, what little we're beginning to understand, the scientists are studying. Let's take the sperm whales again. You know, so a friend of mine, Shane Garrow, has been studying sperm whale populations in the Eastern Caribbean Sea near Dominica, and he's identified maybe 20 or 24 families that all speak the same dialect. And he said that the first thing that those whales do when they meet another whale in the middle of the ocean is to say where they are from. So identity matters to them. They say, I am from Dominica. And if the other whale says, I am from some other place, they just go their separate ways. So, you know, when I heard that story, I was reminded of the neighborhoods of New York at the turn of the last century, where you had all these little neighborhoods that were based on language. You had the Irish and the Italians, their own cultures. And it seems that's what whales are doing too. And then we look at beluga whales, right? And in the Canadian Arctic, where I worked with beluga whales, a very hard place to work. And we were only just beginning to understand these cultures up there too with these whales. But scientists published papers just in the last year that say that when a beluga whale baby is born, the family gives it the name of the mom, because in the beginning, the baby is only speaking gibberish like a human baby. But as they begin to learn their language, their dialects, and they're doing proper beluga speak, they get their own name. They're given their own name. So, I mean, how wonderful is that, right? That they have these societies where they greet each other. They're actually saying their names and so forth. And I think it's just the beginning of understanding these rich families and societies in the sea.
Well, now you've been at this for a long time. What's the situation right now? How endangered are they? Have they stopped hunting whales? There was a time when I would protest everything when I was protesting, killing seals and this. And then the past few years, well, especially this last year, I've not been able to handle anything. So I'm wondering, has anything improved?
Well, yes and no. So it's a really important question, Patsy. And here's the situation that, commercial whaling has definitely declined worldwide over the last several decades. And because of that, some of these whale populations have increased. They have rebounded. There are still nations on Earth that still whale. There's, the Russians, the Icelandic populations, Norwegians, Japanese. There's still commercial whaling going on. So that is still a problem for those individual whales. But I think the bigger problem is the things that we are doing to the ocean.
Oh,
right?
The pollution.
So
pollution.
We are terrestrial creatures, and we live on land, and we see our world from that terrestrial-centric viewpoint. But if you look at Earth from space, you instantly see that we very much live on a water planet. You know, it's often been said that about three-quarters of the Earth's surface is ocean, but maybe a more important statistic is that 98% of Earth's biosphere, 98% of where life can exist on Earth is ocean, is water. Every other breath that a human being takes comes from the sea. It is the greatest carbon sink on the planet. It takes in more carbon, gives us back more oxygen, and yet every year we are dumping so much carbon into the atmosphere that the ocean's chemistry is changing. It is becoming like acid. It is becoming acidic, and it's killing many things in the ocean. We dump 18 billion pounds of plastic into the ocean every year. We've taken 90% of the big fish out of the ocean in the last 50 or 60 years. So we are destroying the ocean world that we need to survive. So with Secrets of the Whales, with the book and the magazine story and the four-part Disney series streaming on Earth Day, what we're trying to do is, it's not about bad news. It's a celebration of these whales and their families, their babies, and their cultures and all of these wonderful things. But maybe audiences will take away from that a different perception of the natural world and our connection to it. We're not alone on this planet. There are other interesting, complex societies that do the things that we do. They sing songs, they play games, they celebrate the birth of their babies, they mourn the death of members of their family. And maybe if we see the world that way, we might be better custodians of this planet.
Well, I hope so. And I think Secrets of the Whales and your book, which is just brilliant. And then, of course, James Cameron, that must have been a thrill to be able to work with him.
It was.
Wow.
Absolutely. I've known James for years. This was the first project we worked together on, and having him as an executive producer on this was just brilliant. He brings such a unique set of skills. He's a master storyteller of film, of course, but he's also a pioneering ocean explorer. So he gets both of those things, and as an executive producer, can really shape the narrative for this series.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be absolutely fascinating, and everybody, I hope they will watch it. And of course, it's narrated by Sigourney Weaver, and I love her voice.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that so much. And meanwhile, it's just so wonderful what you've done here over the years to just keep this to the forefront, that we have to just appreciate what we have on Earth or in the ocean, just the beauty of it. And I still don't understand that. I don't think there's any necessity for any whale killing. I don't think they have any value that, you can get all of whatever they get from it somewhere else. You don't need it. And
absolutely.
I'm sure Most people would prefer, if there's anybody who eats blubber anymore, which I don't think so, but I'm sure they'd prefer Big Mac. So, you know.
There you go.
You know?
Well, you make a good point. And I think, you know, the message that I've learned after 40-plus years of exploring nature, telling stories, is that everything is connected. Everything matters. You know, the giant whales need tiny little krill and copepod, and coral reefs can't survive without seagrass beds and mangroves, and none of us can survive without the ocean and the trees and everything. So, you know, this planet is like the finely crafted Swiss watch. You know, every gear is important, and as we begin to remove those gears, it falls apart. So that's what I've learned, you know, that nothing operates in a vacuum, nothing can survive without something else, and that everything is ultimately connected. So on, you know, as we celebrate Earth Day, I think it's important to just see that sort of totality of the planet and how we fit into that equation.
Well, it is a wonderful book. And Brian, I think, as I said, you know, when if I had kids again, I would say to them, you know, instead of encouraging them to go to law school and med school, yeah, I'd say become a National Geographic photographer. And because it is a job. Well, it's a job. You get paid to do something that you absolutely love, and that is just enriches your life and enriches everybody else's life.
Well, I've been very blessed to do what I do. It is a dream come true, and I won't argue with you. It's been fantastic.
And it shows that when you're young, if you decide to do something and you want to do it, if you work really hard, you train, you do everything you need to learn how to do your job, you can really succeed. And you've come to the top, to the very top.
Dreams do come true, and if I can do it, anybody can do it. So I agree with you.
Yeah, dreams do come true, and I wanted to. What was you've been you've been chosen all sorts of honors. I don't have the list here with me, but you've received You've received all sorts of honors from National Geographic, from other organizations. Oh, what is this Rolex? You're something with Rolex.
Yeah, in 2017, I was named the National Geographic Rolex Explorer of the Year.
Whoa, that's cool.
That a great honor.
And they gave you a Rolex, I hope?
They did give me a Rolex. And that night after receiving that award, that I didn't have to ask directions to get back to my hotel.
That's fantastic. What an honor, and you deserve it. Really, Brian Scarry, I think you are absolutely fantastic. Just the top. I think you're the only guest I've ever had who actually spoke at the United Nations too, right?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did speak to the General Assembly a few years ago.
My goodness. So you're the first guest I've had on who spoke to the General Assembly. You are a real star, and I am so thrilled that you joined me today on Joy on Paper. Everybody, get this book. It's available wherever books are sold, of course, online. You will love it. It's a perfect gift. Mother's Day's coming up. Mothers will love it because there's touching stories of motherhood. And Father's Day's coming up. Again, always a Nat Geo book is perfect. And this one is particularly perfect this year because it is going to be Earth Day. And Secrets of the Whales is a brilliant book. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much, Patsy. It was a real pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Brian Scarry. What a guy. Oh, fantastic. Bye-bye. All right. And just to update all of you listeners, some of you know, of course, we had Lang Martin Jr. on and Haley Woolbright on a special program. Well, they finally got together up there in Nashville. And so I'm going to play a few minutes of Haley's song, Boxcar, and we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be right back with a wonderful story set in Paris, my favorite place.
Been stowed away on this boxcar for quite some time. We plan to ride it all the way from Maine to Anaheim. Company's gone. I could choose to step off and make my way back home, or I could choose to keep
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, and I have been so looking forward to talking to her because her book is set in my favorite city, Paris, and it's called The Paris Apartment by Kelly Bowen, and I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there, and thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this as well.
Oh, wow. This is terrific. I tell you, well, Paris, what can I say? Paris, the Ritz Hotel. I know it well. I lived in England for many years, and I spent, like, every third weekend, we would go down to Paris. So,
oh, that sounds wonderful.
So I spent a lot of time in Paris. It was so wonderful to read your book, as I'm reading your book, and you're taking me back to Paris. Of course, you know, it's just, what can I say? A beautifully written book. It really is a wonderful story. And it's a dual timeline. I love dual timeline books. And so it was just, for me, when I was there, I would always pretend, in my mind, I was always in another century. So it really just fit me so perfectly that, of course, this book is set in World War II and in present day, and the story is I love the idea. Let's just say, don't we all wish that we would be given a key to an apartment in Paris?
And one that hasn't been touched in decades and decades and decades, of just incredible things.
yes. Well, and you really create that scene so beautifully for us, and the apartment. We want to move in. It's,
you and me both.
Oh boy. What? Of course. Did it come from the idea where they found that apartment of several years ago that had been locked and?
It did. I had come across that a number of years ago, and it just the idea of someone just kind of leaving everything behind, and I know it was lived in a little bit after she left, but the DeFlorian apartment where she fled the Nazis never to return, and the artwork and everything that was left behind was definitely a source of inspiration that they kind of started that story off.
So your main character, Aurelia Leclerc, but she's called Leah, right?
Yeah.
And so Leah gets his key. Like, oh God. I used to always be very nice to little old French ladies when I went to, I never knew, you know, maybe they'd adopt me. Nobody ever did, you know. And there she gets this key. So why don't you tell this story? What happens next? I mean, this was so much fun to read this.
So Leah gets this key to the apartment. She's inherited it from her grandmother. She knows nothing about this apartment. No one in her family knows nothing about this apartment. They didn't even know that her grandmother had at one point in time lived in Paris. So her grandmother was a kind of a rigid, kind of reserved woman, and she thought that she knew her well, but as she walks into this apartment, she realizes that she doesn't know her at all. And as she walks into this apartment, the apartment's full of beautiful furnishings and couture gowns and a lot of art, lots and lots of art. And as Leah walks in, there's also some other things in the apartment that makes her think perhaps her grandmother might not have been on the right side of history. And that's kind of the turning point. And from there, she reaches out to an art restorer in London, Gabriel Seymour, connected through a very small painting that she discovers. And without, I think that's as far as I'm going to go. Without
exactly, exactly. We're not going to give it away. We're not going to give it away. But we do go back in time and discover a lot of things. There are many, many different threads.
Yeah, and discover that the past narrative is the tale of two women who approached the war with very divergent approaches and formed a very unlikely partnership.
And it's also funny when I lived in England. My husband had a small plane, so we used to fly to Europe with his plane.
Right.
So we would take the route that you describe. We would fly over France. We'd fly over Germany. And I, again, you know, being a person who reads a lot of books, I was always pretending that I was going to join the resistance. And you know, I never did jump out of the plane over Paris or over France. I never went that far. But that scene that you have there about the parachute jump, very, very nicely written.
I took that. I read a lot of memoirs. Pearl Witherington has just a fascinating memoir. She was one of the women who was recruited by the SOE. And in her memoir, she writes in very great detail what that experience was like and what she felt and what she heard and what she saw. So I leaned heavily on her experiences to inspire that scene as I was writing it.
Well, I realized you had to have spoken or read something, unless you did it yourself. I wasn't sure. because I have, of course, I have done it myself, but I never jumped in Europe. I jumped in England. Because my husband flew out of one of the old World War II grass airfields.
Okay.
And so that was our home away from home. We spent half our life there at that airfield because he was flying and I would be sitting around the bar drinking gin and tonics with the old RAF guys. So I was so thrilled when I got to that scene. I read it a couple of times. I said, oh, yeah, that's exactly how you feel.
I'm glad I've got it. I have never jumped out of a plane yet, so I'm glad I was able to capture that.
You did well. You should have. go and do it and check it out. It's fun. It is fun. But then speaking about what was it like? I don't know how did you know your research. I mean, you've done a lot of research here, and you really do bring so many aspects of Paris alive for me, because as I said, I've been there many times, know the streets very well, know the Ritz Hotel. What was it like for you in Paris? What grabbed you about Paris to write this book?
I think traveling through Paris, I haven't been to Paris. It's been probably about 10 years since I was in Paris, but just walking through the city and the ability just to have so much history surrounded, like you can touch history there, and there's so many centuries of stories from all sorts of conflicts and revolutions and like the artistry and the architecture. I mean, just it's a lot put into one city, and there's something for everyone. And traveling then out of Paris and then into Normandy, like in the D-Day beaches, you get a real feel for the people that were there during the occupation or during the Second World War, what they saw or what they felt.
Well, you do. I think you've done a really great job with this writing. I don't want to tell too much about the World War II side of the story, but let's just tell a little bit about a little bit about the two main characters.
So the two main characters in the past narrative are named Estelle and Sophie, and they both come into the war in a very different manner, and I won't say anything more about that, no spoilers. But Sophie is recruited by the Special Operations Executive, and she is one of the first women to be placed in a combat role on the Western Front. So while women on the Eastern Front were pretty common, if you read the Russian memoirs of the snipers and the tank gunners and the fighter pilots, on the Western Front, they were very reluctant to put women into war, basically until they literally had run out of options at that point in time, kind of irregular male combat soldiers put into in a covert position, probably had a life expectancy of about 3 months behind enemy lines. So they started putting women behind there, thinking that they would be less of a Nazi target. So Sophie is one of those women. And Estelle, I'm trying not to do too many spoilers here. Estelle is one of the women in Paris who helps her.
And a beautiful woman. And let's talk a little bit about the Ritz Hotel, because that plays a very important role in your story, and I love the place. So let's talk about the Ritz Hotel.
The Ritz Hotel is incredible. It was a palace before it was a hotel. It was bought by Caesar Ritz, who turned it into a hotel. It was quite advanced for its time in terms of very light and airy. Every room had like a bathroom and washing station, and it was just completely over the top, beautiful. It attracted the very wealthy. It attracted the artists. It attracted just a very wide array of people in the city during that time, and from all over, from internationally as well. And it was kind of the place to be.
And it still is. Boy, oh boy.
It still is. Oh boy. It still is. And it's been renovated. I haven't seen it since it's been renovated, so I'm looking forward to one day traveling again.
So did you get a tour? Did they give you a tour?
I picked myself on a small tour in the bottom of it and on the outside of it. But, of course, I didn't get to see the Imperial Suite or the Coco Chanel Suite or any of those types of suites. I relied, when I wrote this book, I relied almost exclusively on old photographs that they're quite abundant, actually. And Ernest Hemingway was very profuse in his description of the hotel.
Oh, yes. And it's funny, really, it's difficult to get into the hotel. So it's not, Americans will sometimes get up to the door, then they stop you. Particularly nowadays, you can't get in there.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it is fascinating. And the reason I was able to get in wasn't so much that my husband in those days when we lived there in Europe, he wore a cowboy hat. he always wore this
right.
cowboy hat. He looked so gorgeous in a cowboy hat. So he could get into any place, and you could just walk into the Ritz Hotel and they would open the door for him and greet him like they knew him forever. Like, you know, he was Gary Cooper or something coming for Love in the Afternoon. So, so that's why I love that hotel. And I just love having the story about it. I like couture gowns. I like all of the fashion. And of course, the art that you talk about in the book is fascinating. And one of the great things about this book, and I have to tell my listeners, because so many of them do belong to library groups or reading groups, you have, I think, one of the very, very best questions for readers that you have in the back of your book. It's really very comprehensive and a great, great tool for people who, you know, belong to different reading groups. And nowadays, even on Zoom, women who men, but particularly women like to get together. I know at my synagogue, they have a reading group. And this is the kind of book that they would love, and that you have these great reading notes, I think is terrific.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm glad I could provide some extra information or extra thought-provoking questions.
Well, I do want to encourage people, if you, you know, have a bunch of friends, you know, get together. Everybody get this book. You all order this book. It's called The Paris Apartment, and it's by Kelly Bowen. And this is your first, I know you've written a lot of romance, but this is your first sort of
Yes, this is my first historical fiction.
And it's a great book, and exactly the kind of book that all of you girls out there can, girls and gals, I don't know, can we call girls and gals? I don't know what we can call people anymore. Just everybody, anybody.
Everybody.
Get on Zoom and have, you know, get yourself a glass of wine or a Pernod. Oh, every once in a while, I just want a Pernod, you know, oh, or a Calvados, and just get together and also maybe some chocolate eclairs, some croissants. I'm thinking of all the food that we can get.
Yes, you can be inspired with food here. That's for sure.
That's for sure, because, well, you know, some people in France had no food, and then some people at the Ritz Hotel had food.
Yeah, it was a very strange juxtaposition, and I do address that in my book as well.
Yeah, and so I was thinking quite a bit about food when I was reading this, and as you said, now you haven't been there for 10 years, but the truth is, once you've been to Paris, it is one of those cities that stays in your heart and mind forever.
It's just something
very special about the city, and I can see that you enjoyed your time there because you write about it so nicely.
It's hard not to enjoy your time there. Like I said, whatever you love, if you love art or architecture or food or just history or stories or literature, it's all there. There is literally something there for everyone, and it's such a beautiful, diverse place.
And, of course, I want to go back to the art because it's very important that people realize that at that time the Nazis were stealing art that belonged to, you know, people who treasured it, and they stole it, and they also were destroying art that they didn't like.
Absolutely. It was the biggest art theft in history. They stole it. They just took it. They bought some, and I use that term very loosely, is basically they extorted it, or they basically stole it, forced sales, that sort of thing. And lots of the Impressionist artists or Expressionists, they simply destroyed it. It was degenerate art, and it was simply destroyed. And then, of course, lots of it was simply shipped out of the countries, and it was all theoretically sent back to to Germany, where Hitler was going to have this beautiful museum that he was going to name, and so much of the art is still missing. And I know people say, "Well, you can't equate a human life with a piece of art." But what my characters talk about and it kind of experience in the story is what that art represents, the families that it represents, the tragedy or the families that are ripped apart that are represented by that stolen artwork, or even the history of entire countries or peoples or cultures that's gone, lost forever.
Well, you bring that out really with a heart. It's heartrending when you read about people. I can't stand hearing about people destroying buildings. It's like, you know, of course, you mentioned Winston Churchill in this book, and I love Winston Churchill. And one of the things he said, you know, inventions and all of the advancements in the world are moving so quickly. And he was talking back there in the 40s. But he said, unfortunately, the human mind isn't moving forward as quickly. It doesn't get better. There's still so many evil things that you think people would have realized were wrong. And so I think you brought that out too, that you have to really stop and say, why would these people do this? Cultured people, intelligent people, destroy art or destroy buildings or destroy human beings.
And there's those that took an active role and those that just shrugged their shoulders and looked the other way. And it's hard to comprehend.
It is. And I think it's great to read this book, because one of the wonderful things about a book like this is it opens people's eyes, and it does make them start to question, make them start to understand what you know, what happened at that time, and perhaps have a new outlook on life in general. Because one of the things is that you wrote somewhere in where I'm trying to find the part. There's a letter at near the end, and it's from Sophie, and it's to her. It's dearest Will, and she wrote it to her brother. And I love the way you end that letter. It says, "Will, make every day count. Make every day count." And that is such a perfect thing to say. And I hope that the people now who, you know, we've been going through this pandemic, and if they're going to be doing this on Zoom, that they understand when they get to that line where she writes, where Sophie writes, make every day count, that people just stop and say, yes, yes, we have to do that.
Yeah, I think so. That was important to me. I mean, it's important to me in my life, and it's important to me in what I write. And this book particularly is kind of about second chances. And in this one, these characters get that second chance. And it's kind of a challenge to them or to the reader just to look forward, make an effort to make things count, like make a difference, do something for the better.
Exactly. And you've done it beautifully with this book. I like the character, Leah LeClaire. I think beautifully written. And, of course, I like Gabrielle Seymour, the art historian, and also a very interesting character. And I think, you know, the whole dual timeline is you've done it so well. And I want to just encourage people to get this book. It's by Kelly Bowen. It's called The Paris Apartment. And Kelly, do you have a website you want people to go to?
I do. It's just kellybowen.net. And there's all sorts of information on there. If you want to know the personal history behind this book, kind of my family history behind this book, it's there if you want to check it out.
It's fast. It's a great website. Yeah. Exactly. And I love the cover art. Beautiful. Who did it again?
This is Forever, Grand Central. They're Forever imprint, and they did the cover art, and there are some extremely talented folks over there, and they just did a beautiful job on that cover.
Oh, it is. It's just lovely. And a book that people will really enjoy, the entire book. I think you've done a beautiful job, Kelly. And it's really, you know, when I got it, it was funny. I was in a strange mood when I got it. And when I sat down and started reading it, I went back in time when I got to the World War II sections. And I don't know, something about the way you wrote it, I just felt like I was really happy to learn about those people who were strong, those people who did make a difference. And I want to really compliment you on that.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy. If I can help a reader connect with the story, then I've done my job. So that's the highest compliment. So thank you very much.
Well, you certainly have. And again, everybody, for book clubs and get-togethers, this is a wonderful book, because you have a reading group guide at the back. One of the best, as I said, one of the best I've ever seen an author do, because it's really, the questions are also in-depth and intelligent, and I really like that. So a great book, The Paris Apartment by Kelly Bowen. And Kelly, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a real joy. You have found the joy on paper with this book, and I want to thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your kind words, and thank you for having me here. It's been wonderful.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, what a fascinating woman, and a her website is interesting. Her family history is interesting, and I think you will enjoy this book. I love dual timelines. Tasha Alexander, of course, does dual timelines. V.M. Burns. I love V.M. Burns' dual timeline. She does Victorian and modern day. And so I just enjoy that. It's, you get sort of two books in one. And I like the comparison. And it really is a way to bring out history and to look at things in a different light. And I think it's fascinating. And when somebody does it well, like Kelly did, as I said, she's before this, she's written a lot of romances. But this one, which is nice historical fiction, I think you will enjoy it. So I was really thrilled to have it. Anyway, what a day, what a day, a big day. My goodness, when I think about this whale book, wow, wow. Anyway, and so check out Kelly's website. Wonderful, but also do go to Brian Scarry's website. He's got a lot of photos there of his encounters with whales, and you will really find it fascinating. And then stay tuned in May. I will announce also a couple of times when the documentary comes out. I'm sure it's going to be done just brilliantly, of course, with James Cameron. What else would it be? And what can we do? Just everybody has to do their part. And one of the things that I do wish that people would be careful about what they dump into the oceans, and particularly if you have drugs to get rid of, if you have pills to get rid of, to do it the proper way and don't put them down the toilet. This is so ridiculous that people do this. And they make it actually a little bit difficult to find a location where you can get rid of drugs in a proper way, because it really is awful if you're going to just dump them down the toilet. Eventually everything goes into the ocean and the whales don't need it. And I don't know. I don't think they have anxiety. People are putting so many pills in the ocean. I don't know what they're doing. Anyway, what else? Oh, I want to again thank you. Remember, my webpage is radio-joyonpaper, and there is a form at the bottom that you can fill in, and you can ask me questions, or you can ask questions about intellectual property. Bill Larson is going to be on the program in a few weeks, and he's going to be talking more about intellectual property. There have been a few more cases recently. People, you know, have time on their hands, and they're getting themselves in trouble. So people, really think about what you're going to put on your Facebook page. You don't want to get sued by somebody because you said something or written something on your Facebook page that's inappropriate. I'm just warning you not to do it, and Bill Larson will tell you why and how you can get sued. And you just want to make sure that if you have any intellectual property questions, go to my webpage and just fill in that form, send it to me, and I will have Bill when he, I think he's going to actually come to the studio finally. It's been a year since he's been at the studio. Anyway, everybody, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. Like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, I want her Witch City Mysteries to be a series on the Hallmark Channel. And she's going to be with us soon, and we're going to be talking about her new book. So everybody, oh, whoa, lots of things coming up. And I just want to, again, tell everyone, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And there he is. He's saluting me. And I'm saluting him because I should have been a general. Oh, my goodness. What a general I would have been. Oh, terrific. And I would be getting a heck of a pension. Okay, bye-bye, everybody. Take care. Have a nice day.